Morning.
Whoa.
Sorry, this one's still on. I'm banging around and the mic's still on. Well, good morning. My name's Reg Morris. I'm one of the leaders here. Welcome at home as well. If you're watching online, it's great to have you with us. And I'll add my welcome to Liam's too. It's really good to have you with us this morning. Now, the image of Jesus as our shepherd has been a source of comfort for Christians for thousands of years. And I don't know about you, but what I can think, I can look back and see that where I find comfort kind of changes through different stages of my life. Maybe our earliest experiences of comfort come from, come from something to hold or snuggle, like a blanket or a toy or something like that. And I can remember in my teens that my comfort came from trying to do well in exams, essentially because I wanted to do better than my older brother. And then on into my 20s, and I think that it's finding a wife that's going to make me feel that life's okay, and that worked out pretty well. And then around the same time, getting into a career, because that would make me feel secure and valued. And then I hit parenting. Oh, my. And then, I mean, you parents know the questions that constantly go through your mind. Am I doing this right? Is this okay? And you'll find some people that say, yeah, you're doing a great job, just keep doing what you're doing. And others who are experts or experienced parents saying, no, 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 you're doing it completely wrong. And comfort ends up becoming just knowing that your kids are going to turn out all right and you're not ruining them. And maybe comfort for you, though, is in a favorable prognosis. Or maybe comfort is thinking about leaving a legacy that someone will remember you well. Now, about 50 years after the start of the Protestant Reformation, which was all about the revolution that took place in the Western Church in the 16th century that led to what we now call Protestantism, it was 1563, and the entire theological faculty Heidelberg University in Germany. They came together to put together a resource to teach people the basic foundations of the Christian faith. And the very first question that they ask in this resource is this: what is your only comfort in life or death? They didn't say, what's your greatest comfort? They didn't say, what's your comfort in this or in that time of life? They said, what's your only comfort? And their answer was this: that I am not my own, but belong with body and soul, both in life and in death, to my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. Their answer was that ultimate peace is not an outcome, and it's not found in results, but ultimate peace is found in surrendering to Jesus' authority. Now, for that to be true, it kind of depends on what kind of authority Jesus has, how he uses that authority, what kind of ruler he might be. Does he, for example, have my best interests at heart? And so as we dig back through the passage that we've read in John chapter 10, we'll see how Jesus reveals himself as the Good Shepherd, which is a metaphor that captures the essence of how he uses his authority. And Charis happily, helpfully read the passage for us earlier, but keep it open in front of you because we're going to go back over it and refer to it as we work through it together. And as you read this, you might have thought to yourself, why all this talk about shepherds? And in the chapter up to this point, about sheep and sheep pens and gates and thieves and robbers. What's prompted that? Where's it all come from? It's not from nowhere. And it makes for some wonderful, motivating Christian posters. But why is it there? Why does Jesus use this language about shepherds? And here's my conclusion about why all this talk about shepherding. Because Jesus is talking into a world of shepherding gone wrong. He's speaking into a world of shepherding gone wrong. Now, let me try and explain that. You see, what we need to know about chapter 10 of the book of John, and this is profound stuff, is that it's connected to John chapter 9. And I say that because you need to know what happened in John chapter 9. It just continues through into chapter 10. It's not like it's another day or anything like that. It's not really that profound, but it's important to understand that. It's just that a different chapter has arrived. And in the previous chapter, what we get in this wider context is what's been going on, which is that Jesus has healed a blind man, and it's a beautiful, wonderful healing. And the religious leaders have gone mental. And they're fuming and they hate that this has happened. And they interrogate this newly seeing man, not once but twice. He's been healed, and the religious leaders, they interrogate him. And the interrogation doesn't just go on for him, it extends to his wider family. His mum and his dad get the treatment as well. And the culmination of all of this is chapter 9 and verse 38. The man is verbally abused, he's roughly treated. And eventually, if this is a word, he is de-synagogued, right? He's kicked out of the synagogue, cast out of Judaism, and that would have had severe repercussions for him socially as well as spiritually in those days. So that's what's just happened. And Jesus saw a real-world display of the abuse of power, and he spoke right into it. He saw a world of shepherding gone wrong. This is how you don't do it, is what I've been going on in chapter 9. And hopefully that orients us to what's going on in chapter 10. And that proposition helps us with the fact that Jesus is speaking into our world, our contemporary real world, where people in authority and positions of power so often abuse that authority and abuse that power, which can make it really hard for us to trust people claiming to have authority. And it seems that every week, perhaps every day, our headlines are filled with stories of misconduct, abuse of power, and the misuse of power and authority. We're too familiar, aren't we, with headlines from charities and councils and governments and businesses and even churches relating to misconduct and the abuse of power by people in positions of influence. And Jesus is speaking right into it. So this is not just about, you know, cute pictures of pretty green fields and happy shepherds and content sheep. It's speaking into a world of shepherding gone wrong. And Jesus using imagery about sheep and shepherding would have drawn his listeners, who were the religious elite, back to the Old Testament references about the world of shepherding. And that Old Testament background, that would have been painfully clear to the bad shepherds, to those who were doing it wrong as they heard Jesus speak. And one of these passages is in Ezekiel chapter 34. And this is God speaking to the bad shepherds of the day. You have not strengthened the weak or healed those who are ill or bound up the injured. You've not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You've ruled them harshly and brutally. And so when Jesus is using the language of shepherding, he's pointing out bad shepherds. But he's not just there to point out the problems. He's showing us how shepherding can be done, what good shepherding looks like. And that is one thing. If you track the course of this chapter to the point where we start reading, at the start of the chapter, Jesus, he's teaching people using the illustration of shepherding, and they just don't get it. Then in verse 7, he changes tack, and he does something they weren't expecting. He changes course entirely, and it looks something like this. So verses 1 to 5, Jesus doesn't mention himself at all, right? He's talking about concepts and ideas. He's describing stuff. And then from verse 7 onwards, he does something different. He goes from telling the story to stepping into the story. And he steps into his own parable. And he starts talking about himself, which is what he's then doing in the passage that we are looking at. So, you see, we can conclude from that that Jesus, he's not just talking about a world of shepherding gone wrong, but he's stepping into a world of shepherding gone wrong. He's saying all these things, having entered our world, having actually encountered and spoken into and stepped into a world of shepherding gone wrong. So we're just going to walk back through the passage and we're going to dig into it as we go so we can see what Jesus means by calling himself the Good Shepherd. I'm going to go with three attributes of Jesus that we see from these verses that should give us confidence in his authority and his commitment to us as the Good Shepherd. And the first one is this, that we can see that Jesus protects sacrificially. You see, Jesus, he's contrasting himself to the hired hands, the bad shepherds. They're the guys who run away when it gets tough. There's unreliability, there's self-preservation, there are broken promises in the character and in the actions of the hired hands. You can't trust what they say or what they do. And Jesus, he's talking about the bad shepherds. Again, remember the reference back to Ezekiel. He's aiming a shot at the Pharisees. And they'd have known that. It would have been pretty painful for them. And Jesus is saying, I'm no hired hand. It's with great personal angst that I watch these sheep. And why is that? Because they're mine. They're my own. So that when Christ sees us, those of us who are Christians, he sees something that belongs to him. He's not a hired hand, and he's not going to bail out in the day of trouble. In fact, he says in this text that as the wolf comes, he will not flee. He will not abandon us. And the wolf imagery here isn't, it's not just about like random difficulties that might befall us in life. He's talking about the great enemy of all souls, which is sin and death. And what he says here is in the face of snarling, bloodthirsty evil, he does not flee and he does not abandon us because he's not a hired hand and we are his. And the text, look, it's not a promise that we won't have difficulty, but rather, eternally speaking, that we are secure in the Good Shepherd. Jesus is saying, when it comes to the enemy, eternally, you are secure in me. And how can that be? Well, Jesus explains it because I am the Good Shepherd, I know my sheep, and my sheep know me, and I lay down my life for the sheep. He's talking about his sacrificial death, because a shepherd in the sheep enclosure out in the wilderness would lay down his life every night. He'd lie down in the opening and become the door to the sheep pen, which would mean if a pack of wolves came, he could die if he didn't protect himself. You know that phrase, over my dead body? Well, that would be a real prospect for these guys in the first century. Jesus is saying, I'm laying down my life for the sheep. And the word for, and this is important, is the Greek word that means on behalf of, or instead of, or in place of. I'm going to lay down my life in death in the place of, on behalf of, the sheep, people, so that they don't have to die. I'll take it upon myself. And there's a big theological term for that, substitutionary death, or vicarious atonement. And four times, Jesus refers to it in this passage. You see, shepherding's a risky business. You remember David, King David, before he was king and before the whole Goliath thing happened, he was just a little shepherd boy. And he was being interviewed by King Saul. And David said, you know, King, I'm a shepherd and I'm really good with a stone and a sling. And by the way, whenever a bear or a lion came in and took a sheep, I would chase that sheep down. And I would get it from the predator's mouth and I would deliver it. It's dangerous work. And I did some digging because I wanted to find out some facts about how dangerous being a shepherd is nowadays. And the only organization I could find that reports any stats on anything like this is the National Agricultural Statistical Service in the US. And they report that in 1 year, almost 250,000 sheep die by predatory animals. That's a lot, isn't it? That's a lot of sheep. So it's risky business. And of course, Jesus paid the ultimate price because he laid down his life. But keep that in mind for now because he's then going to complete the sentence. And our second point is that Jesus leads purposefully. Let's just read verses 16 to 18 again. Where are we? 16 to 18. I have other sheep that are not of this sheepfold. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father. And if you see it at the end of verse 16, I lay down my life only to take it up again. So that's the rest of it. I'm laying it down in death and I'm taking it again in resurrection. Jesus laying down his life was not the end of the story. The end of the story was that he laid it down that he might take it up again. And we have to learn and remember the end of the sentence, don't we? And what I want us to see in terms of Jesus about the cross is that when he laid down his life, when he went to the cross and he died, that wasn't a disaster, it was a design. Not a disaster, it was a design. He announced it in advance, I'm laying down my life that I might take it up again. And if you're not yet in a place where you've accepted the truth, this truth for yourself, then let me just once again simply explain the significance of the cross. You see, Jesus lived as a human man in perfect obedience to God's will. He was blameless, even though he was tempted in every way that we've been tempted, and yet without failing in any way. And that's what the Bible says about Jesus, and that Jesus lives that perfect life and is then killed on the cross. And when he dies on the cross, what the cross is all about is that he is absorbing all of God's wrath, all of his judgment, because God is perfect. And any imperfection in us creates a barrier in our relationship with God. And the result of that is for anyone who believes in him, who believes in Jesus as their Lord, all of that sin, all of their faults, past, present, and future, they're fully absorbed by Christ. So that the Christian is now seen by God through the lens of the cross of Christ, and he sees us as spotless and blameless. Isn't that a marvelous truth? That Jesus would lay down his life, the good shepherd, so that eternally speaking, the wolf of sin and death might growl and snarl, but at worst could just gum us a bit because his teeth are gone. Just check back to verse 18 again, because I wanted to draw attention back to this. I have other sheep that are not of the sheep pen. I must bring them also, and they too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. And Jesus is speaking to those outside of the flock, as the people who were listening would have understood it at the time. That was the fold of Judaism. The Gentiles he's speaking to. He's speaking about non-Jewish people. And that's me, and that's probably most of you, I would guess. And the gospel was to go from Jerusalem, then Judea, and then out through Samaria to the outermost parts of the earth. And we are other sheep, as he refers to here. And the Apostle Paul, who wrote large chunks of the New Testament, in his letter to the Ephesians, he talks about the mystery that was kept from people knowing this in the Old Testament, but now it's revealed in Christ. And the mystery isn't that Gentiles would be saved, nor that the Jews would be saved. It's that the Jews and the Gentiles would live together in the same body, the same group, the same fold. Other sheep I have. There will be one flock, one shepherd, because we're all related by Jesus. We're brothers and sisters because of Jesus. And why is that important? Because in those days, at that time, there were the Jews believed there were two people in the earth. There were Jews and there was everybody else. Jews were going to heaven because of the covenant made with Abraham. Do you remember all that stuff from Joseph for the last few weeks? And the covenant of the law that they maintained given by Moses. They're going to heaven by bloodline and the law of Moses. And there's everyone else, the Gentiles. And Jesus shocks the Pharisees, the bad shepherds again, right there, saying that being led by the good shepherd was not restricted to the Jews. He would be shepherd to all. They too will listen to my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. And Jesus is purposefully fulfilling God's grand plan to have all people reconciled to him. He's leading purposefully in bringing about salvation to all. And the third thing is that Jesus knows intimately. Now, I've been doing a bit of research recently into AI, into artificial intelligence, partly because somebody asked me to speak at a conference thinking that I might have something useful to say about this and how you can use artificial intelligence in insurance. Now, it's pretty fascinating, deeply exciting. I'm not going to go there now. If you want to ask me about it, I can give it a go. And as I was doing that, I was also preparing for this sermon, and I thought I'm going to give it a go and ask a couple of AI tools to write my sermon. This is not this one, by the way, but I asked a couple of, and this is, you can't read any of that, but that's just some of the stuff they came out with. They weren't the best. They weren't shockingly bad, as in heretical or anything like that, but they were just not great. But here's an actual thing. Another thing I discovered about AI is that it's being used to help farmers identify their sheep using facial recognition. This is a true thing, all right? This is a fact. And why is that technology so useful? Because it's really hard to tell sheep apart. But good shepherds know their sheep well. They know that if one is missing, which one it is. Not only do they know it's missing, but they care enough to go and track it down. And there's another parable that Jesus told about seeking the one lost sheep and not giving up until it's found. But the thing about using facial recognition for identifying your sheep is that it removes the need for you to know your sheep individually or personally. You don't really need to know them, do you? You don't need to spend time learning about them or what makes Larry different to Sean, because AI will do that for you. Is that being known? I think it feels as much like being known as putting my face in front of my phone to unlock it. It might recognize me, but there are big differences between being recognized and being known, aren't there? Look at how Jesus, the Good Shepherd, explains how he knows his sheep. The depth of intimacy is striking, right? And if we hadn't yet just appreciated how well known we are to Jesus, then see how he describes it in verse 15. He says, "Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father." How well does Jesus know us? As well as he knows his Father, and his Father knows him. Even, you know, our understanding of fatherhood in human terms, or our picture of what we love fatherhood to be for us, can't fully reflect what the relationship between Jesus and his Father implies. And we don't have time to fully unpack that now, but John, who wrote this eyewitness account of the life of Jesus that we're reading from today, he gives us a couple of pointers that give us a sense of that relationship. There's one right at the start of his book in John chapter 1 and the first verse, which says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning." And the Word here is a title for Jesus carried over from the Old Testament. And just a little later in the chapter, which Liam's going to be covering next week, we read in verse 30, "I and the Father are one." So this is a relationship. It's beyond close, right? Just from these few verses, we can see that it's eternal, it's united, it's powerful, it's knowing, it's intimate. It's beyond our understanding because we've never encountered being known like this in our human experience. And Jesus says, this is how we are known by him. Even when we're surrounded by our best friends or our closest family, you know, we live in a world that's increasingly marked by disconnectedness. We might feel that we've got real friends that we're really close to, or maybe, you know, maybe our concept of friendship has been defined by remote relationships on social media that we're, you know, forever trying to seek or get approval from. Our great yearning is to be known, and because we're known, to be greeted. And being greeted by someone who at least knows a little about us. There's this tension that we all experience of wanting to be known, yet afraid to be fully known. And the pastor and author, Tim Keller, puts it like this. He says, "To be loved but not known is comforting but superficial. To be known and not loved is our greatest fear, but to be fully known and truly loved, well, that's a lot like being loved by God. It's what we need more than anything. It liberates us from pretense, humbles us out of our self-righteousness, and fortifies us for any difficulty life can throw at us." And Jesus comes to us and says, when your friends have failed, when your relationships are fractured, when your disappointments have overtaken you, and your anxiety has robbed you of your comfort from there right in front of you, remember that I am the good shepherd. I know you as well as the Father and I know each other. That's mind-blowing, isn't it? And there's a principle that I want us to see. See, Jesus is explaining that he's the shepherd, that he's not just the shepherd, he's the good shepherd. And what makes him good? Well, he lays down his life for the sheep. What else makes him a good shepherd? He didn't stay down, he gets right back up. Resurrection and the offer of salvation, that entering his fold and the certainty of eternity with him. And you might hear that and go, why would that make him a good shepherd? Because Jesus said, I'll never leave or forsake you. Just like a shepherd concerned for his sheep, concerned enough to go searching for the lost ones, ones he knows intimately. But if Jesus is dead permanently, he can't fulfill that promise, can he? If he gets up from the dead, he could do that. He could now fulfill that promise. If he lives forever and says, guess what? I'm always going to be with you. I'm always going to be there. Just abide in me. I'll come to you. I'll give you my strength. I'll be with you to the end of the age. Now that promise then makes sense, right? So that's a great aspect of this good shepherd. And so now Jesus is now in heaven, and do you know what he's doing with the Father? He's seated at the right hand of the Father, but he's working. His work didn't end at the cross. His redemptive work ended at the cross, but do you know, he's still working today, right now. And what's he doing? He's advocating, he's interceding for you and me. And we read this in Hebrews 7 and verse 25. Therefore, he's able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. He always lives to intercede for them. That is, those who come to God through Jesus. Sometimes we might hear from someone that they're praying for us, and that will probably make us feel good and cared for. It's a great thing to promise to pray for someone, isn't it? But here's better news, that Jesus prays for you to God the Father. His work of intercession goes on. That's a great shepherd. Look at the tense again of Hebrews 7. It's present tense. He lives. Not that he lived or he will live, but he lives. The tense matters because it shows us that Jesus has got an ongoing role in this world. And the good shepherd, knowing us, his sheep, intimately, ought to provoke a reaction in us. And maybe our reaction might be, if you're anything like me, amazement that Jesus doesn't walk away and give up on someone who fails so often. But Jesus, he knows all of that. And what's he doing? He's interceding. He's pleading our case for undeserved but promised forgiveness through grace. Check back to Hebrews 7:25 again. Why is he doing that? Because he's able to save completely those who come to God through him. He's doing it to save us for eternity with him, because he knows us intimately, and therefore he's able to make us people who receive salvation, pleading our case to God the Father. Now, I've just got one application, one quick application to run through before we finish. Now, the imagery of sheep and shepherds, it's repeated throughout the Bible, and often it's not a very positive image, is it? We tend to have a bit of a pop at sheep, sheep going astray and wandering off. And if you've been around church stuff for any period of time, you might have come to anticipate that, you know, the way we might use sheep as an illustration of stupidity, of failing to know the right thing to do, and being incapable of being trusted with making good decisions, they're valid images, right? Those are true things. There's some truth in those caricatures of sheep. But here's an alternative way to think about it, which is this, that sheep are not stupid. Check back again to Ezekiel 34. If we go on from what we read earlier, we read this. For this is what the sovereign Lord says. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so will I look after my sheep. I will rescue them from all the places where they were scattered on a day of clouds and darkness. I myself will tend my sheep and make them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak. But the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice. God's making statements of absolutes. There's no uncertainty in what he's going to do as a shepherd. He will rescue his flock. He will tend his sheep. He will shepherd the flock with justice. And into an environment of bad shepherds, Jesus, God himself in the form of a man, turns up and claims that promise that I am the good shepherd. And what would the sheep-like thing be to do in response to that? Walk away? Fall on my back so that I can't get back on my feet? Mistaken for a wolf? Believe that I don't need a shepherd? Think that my comfort is to be found in following a bad shepherd, whether that's a thing or a person? And Phil Moon mentioned this last week. There's something different about shepherds in the West. In the UK and other countries of the West, that's different from shepherding in the Middle East, which is, you've probably seen shepherds in the UK, they kind of herd their sheep from behind, they drive their sheep from behind, often with sheepdogs, trying to round them up, but always from in behind. Eastern shepherds would lead their sheep. And you still see it today. If you go over to the Middle East, you see a shepherd walking in front of the flock, not driving from behind, leading them. And why would he lead them? Because sheep don't know where they're going. Yeah, you can drive them using sheepdogs, but it's better if you lead them, because sheep will then come to trust you. And actually, shepherds have said, my sheep are very at ease when I'm around them. Because it's like they have this instinct that says, I know that he knows where he's going. He knows where the good food spots are. And he makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters, as David said. So he goes in front of them. He leads them and they follow him. Yet they will by no means follow a stranger. But they'll run away from him, because sheep are not stupid. They've chosen who to trust, and they will stick with their choice. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. But though they're not the smartest, they know their master's voice. And you know, it's funny, whenever we read about being compared to sheep in the Bible, we might react one of two ways. We might not like being told that we're not that smart. And the fact that the Bible calls you a sheep, you're going to hear it one of two ways. You're going to hear it either as an insult, as a put down, or you might hear it as a compliment. And Psalm 23, that famous, the Lord is my shepherd psalm. David, I think, was bragging when he said, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He does this, he does that. Or in other words, I'm a sheep, and that I recognize. But I have it good because I have a good, good shepherd. And he was bragging because in knowing that shepherd, what he promises, the authority with which he promises it, David knows that committing to the good shepherd is his only source of comfort, either in life or in death. In Australia, where there are some big old sheep farms, a man was arrested for stealing sheep. He claimed that he didn't steal them, but they were always his. And the whole thing went to court. And on the stand, the judge and the jury, they cross-examined this guy, as well as the accuser. And the guy who was blaming him for stealing his sheep. And the judge didn't know what to do. He couldn't decide between them. And as a last resort, the judge called his final witness, the sheep. And they were brought into the courtroom. And the judge asked the plaintiff, the one who made the accusation of theft, to go out into the hallway, open the doors of the court, go down the hallway a little bit, keep the doors open, and call the sheep. And he made his call, and the little sheep, they just cowered and hid and ignored him and stayed in the courtroom. And then the accused guy went out, and he called, and the sheep ran straight to him. The judge said, case closed, because the sheep know the shepherd's voice, because they're not stupid, because they recognize their only source of confidence. How much more for us would we not want to be led by a good shepherd? How much more important is it for us to hear the voice of one we trust and to respond? not stupid, not driven, not forced, but led into the certainty of life eternal with Jesus Christ. And if you remember it, Psalm 23 concludes with this wonderful promise, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And as the affectionate host in the house of the Lord, Jesus is longing to welcome us to the infinitely long banquet table to which God invites the human race. Jesus Christ, our only hope in life or in death. Amen. In the quiet of the next minute or so, maybe you'd like to reflect on your source of confidence. And if this all seems just too good to be true, a truly good shepherd in a world of bad shepherding, you know, I can assure you that what we've been reading are the words of Jesus Christ himself. Consider that for yourself and his offer to lead you. Will you be a sheep that follows? And if you already know the good shepherd for yourself, thank him afresh for his sacrificial protection, his purposeful leadership, and his intimate knowledge.